Moving on to the second speaker of this evening, Bernard Hogan Howe, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police Service. He's got degrees from Oxford, an MA in law. He's a diploma in applied criminology and also an MBA. He started his service with South Yorkshire Police, having previously spent 4 years in the health service. And there his career took him through the usual experience range of uniform, CID, traffic, and worked in personnel too. He policed Doncaster's mining community during the miners' strikes of 84-85. In 1997, he went over to Merseyside Police as ACC, initially Community Affairs, and subsequently responsible for area operations. And there he had to oversee the response to the petrol disputes of 2000-2001. Later he went to the Metropolitan Police and was given the challenge of engineering 20% growth in the force, reaching a high point of 30,000 officers. We should hang on to that skill set. You never know, those skills may be required one day in the future, although it doesn't look likely at the minute. He then rejoined Merseyside Police in 2004 as the chief, where he introduced the force total policing model, the subject of this evening's address, focusing on crime, on victims, and on professionalism. The approach led to crime reducing by a third, antisocial behaviour reducing by a quarter, and the highest level of criminal asset recovery outside of London, more than £20 million over 3 years, and I think just a shade ahead of Thames Valley Police, which was also a conspicuous, so they say. He went to be Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary, responsible for oversight of the Met, the City Police, British Transport Police, and others, before completing the poacher trip, going back in to be chief, this time as Commissioner of the Met, where he took up the role on the 12th of September 2011. As Commissioner, he has a very novel approach to visibility, just forcing the point home by going out patrolling regularly on top of a very large horse. And it is a popular game, Spot the Commissioner. Some of you may have seen him at the Royal Wedding. The first sighting was at the Tottenham Hotspur and Wigan game, and officers couldn't quite believe it when the rumour went round that the Commissioner's here and he's on horseback. For the record, Spurs ran out 3-1 winners. Ladies and gentlemen, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Bernard Hogan Howe.
Right, good evening, everybody. And Nick, thanks for the introduction. As Sir Peter said, we did meet some time ago. Our quartet was sadly limited. It was limited mainly by the fact we had four baritones, which I had the soul of a tenor, but the voice of a baritone. And of course, the definition of a baritone is someone who can't quite sing high and can't quite sing low. But we did our best in very difficult circumstances. Peter's quite right to say that we hadn't compared notes, but there were some great echoes in what we're about, certainly what I'm about to talk about, and what Peter mentioned. There's one point of difference which will become apparent, but I think an awful lot of echo, particularly in that urge to embed quality in all we do, to have it evidence-based. And I just want to come back at the end after having talked about some of the Merseyside experience, some of the start we made in the Met, to how I think, you know, the policing professional body needs to have a fundamental bedrock of academia, which I would argue we don't have at the moment. So I'm just going to really talk about, first of all, a little about Merseyside, a little about how we're trying to implement that approach in London, and then something that I hope we could all benefit from in the future to provide a bedrock for evidence-based policing. Now, I'm going to have to be particularly careful because you can see in the audience already, I was having had a quick turnaround to have a check. And the people I've worked with in the past, there's a few up in the top left-hand corner who can see from Merseyside, and a few directly in front of them from the Met. So if there's anything that's inaccurate, inconsistent, then you've got every opportunity to wave your hand about or ask destabilising questions at the end. So I'll try and keep it honest and open, but I hope you'll find that the evidence stands the test. First of all, when I went to Merseyside, I went, as Nick was saying, twice. On the second occasion when I went back as chief, as in any organisation, when you're going to lead it, you have to work out, well, what is it you're going to do with this organisation? You've been practising for long enough, You've now been given the great joy in Merseyside of leading about 7,500 people, providing a service to about 1.5 million people. And it's quite a maturing experience. I would say, well, what is it you're actually going to try and do with this thing? So I came to some fairly simplistic conclusions. First of all, and this is where it's a point of emphasis that I would say in terms of what Pete said, I've always believed that if I led a police force, I wanted it to be a crime-fighting machine. I acknowledge in what Peter said is that, of course, it's not the only thing the police do. But I wanted a mission at which the organisation could group around, which I didn't have to persuade them too much, that this was their reason for being here. And it seems to me in any police force, and that's a very great thing that motivates people. We have cleaners. We have people who are financial experts. We have people who run IT departments. We have detectives. We have response officers. But I would argue that the thing that can motivate them and does is that they think it's a great privilege to fight crime. And for me, that's always been a vital thing, to try and set the mission in a place that your people can follow. And I was always greatly impressed. Nick mentioned that I went to an MBA a few years ago, and I'm not sure whether I carried everything away from the MBA, but one of the things I did carry away was in the organisations that work best, they've often got a clear mission. And the usual trite, perhaps, example that's offered is of the visit to NASA, where someone has to clean them, well, what do? And the answer is, I'm here to put a man on the moon. Now, it may be trite, but I always thought, if I led an organisation, I'd want the people in my organisation to be able to understand clearly what they're there for and to be able to contribute in the way that you've set the mission. So for me, rightly or wrongly, to set that crime-fighting mission had many benefits, and though there were risks, and I would acknowledge those, I think the benefits outweighed the risks. The second part of what we tried to do around total policing was, first of all, to say that we wanted to be the best. Now, of course, you may say, by what criteria do we judge best? I'm going to park that for a second, because it may be something we come back to in questions. But I always thought it was important, as a public service, and I know now Tom's taken on the role of as Chief HMI, the inspectorate who holds us all to account, but it seems to me that in a public service, unless we strive to be better, then we do not have the benefit of competition from others who might compete to provide policing in a certain area. So if you are in London and you're robbed, you will have to come to the Met broadly. You may go to BTP in an underground station. You may go to the City of London if you're in the City of London. But essentially, you're going to have to come to us and you're going to have to receive the policing service that we provide in a geographical area. It seems to me vital that a public service strive all the time to strive to be better, to be more efficient, to be more effective, because you're not going to have someone coming along and say, well, actually, if you've been robbed, come along to my police station over here. Well, certainly not yet, and I don't see that anybody's proposing that at the moment. So for me, it's an honourable thing to try to be best, and in the process, not to cause those forces who are adjacent to you to fail. That really isn't the point. We have 43 forces in England and Wales, another 18 in Scotland, one in Northern Ireland. It's vital that we work together. So the idea is not to be competitive with other forces, it is to be competitive with ourselves, to drive performance to be better. The idea of total came just from two simplistic reasons, really. When I went to Merseyside, there were people in the room who were there when I went, which was back in 2004. And at the time, I followed a regime which had actually pushed particularly neighbourhood policing. And I actually support neighbourhood policing as a bedrock of all we do. We have to be within and part of the community to make sure we deliver a service that they need. But some of the feedback I got as I arrived was that unless you were a neighbourhood policing officer, it seemed as though your contribution didn't count in the same proportion to your effort. So if you're in serious crime, you're in traffic or whatever, it was thought that your contribution wasn't as marked. It seemed to me that you had to get the totality of the organisation to make sure that you could get the best from all the 7,500 members. So just from that simple idea, and then being old enough to remember a Dutch football team that played total football, they never won the World Cup, as it happens, but they played some incredible... Any Dutch people here today? No? Okay. They played some very good football, for those of you who like football. And the main thing was everybody knew what everybody else's contribution was, and if the fullback was out of position, the centre-forward could move back, and vice versa. So everybody was very flexible. They knew the whole plan, and they supported each other in delivering a very stylish form of football. Well, I'm not sure I'm a great stylist, but again, with 7,500 people, you've got a great opportunity for everybody to contribute something towards the overall aim. So quite a simple idea, I think, behind this total approach, and not an awful lot more than that. We divide it into three areas: total war on crime, total support for victims, and in the process to be totally professional. Total war has certain connotations, but the idea was, or is that you can do everything that's legal and ethical to put the criminal on the back foot. Because they'll try and do that to you. So it seems to me that within the law, within the ethics of what policing has to do, then it's vital that we do everything we can to make sure that the criminal is put on the back foot, and that we challenge them, and we do everything that's possible to find them, and then to do something about the criminality that they are using. Secondly, was to have a total support for the victims. You'll know the detection rates probably in this country, which vary. So that for murder detection rates in London at the moment, about 94% of murders are detected. Because car crime, you're talking about less than 10% in most parts of the country. And on average, probably about 25% to 30-odd percent of crimes are detected. Which means that at least two-thirds of the people who are subject to a crime do not get satisfaction of seeing somebody go through the criminal justice system. Which seems to me that if you do not have that benefit, the police still need to care for you. And it can be care at the beginning. I believe strongly in what Peter said, is I think the health service, in my view, has gone more towards the professional and further away from the caring. And certainly my experience of the health service has not been profound in terms of that caring part. So I don't want a service that moves away from, deals with the technical, deals with the transactional, and misses sight of the people. Because the caring part is the thing that people remember, often after they've forgotten the technical achievements that both the police service and others deliver. So for me, it's vital that we actually take care of people as they come to us, often in the worst of circumstances, and we provide them with care. And finally, to be professional in the first two. And that's something about being evidence-based, it's something about providing good training, and it's something about promoting values of which we're proud. So that really was a very simple basis on which we went forward. I mentioned already in terms of context that really we had this NASA idea of having a simple mission. We had the Merseyside previous neighbourhood policing model. But what I wanted to add to that as well was something which I think is based in evidence-based approach to policing, which has been proved time and again, which is about repeat victim, offender and location. I think Peter said that, you know, the smart application of resources can achieve greater things, particularly in a public service, as in most public services, where demand will always overwhelm the ability to supply. In London at the moment, we get about 6 million telephone calls a year. We have 32,000 police officers, 50,000 people who are dedicated to providing policing in London. But we'll never be able really to meet all those needs of those 6 million telephone calls. We have to find smart ways of dealing with the size of the task with the resources on a 24-hour basis, 365 days a year. So for me, the repeat victim offender location theory is something that I believe can really provide a profound link to the way that policing goes forward. But when we've got those evidence-based approaches, I'm going to talk about some of the tactics that we used in Merseyside and we're now employing in London. They seem to me that without having some managerial control of the resources that we have, then all the preaching in the world and all the evidence in the world and all the tactics cannot deliver. There has to be some management that grips the people that we have and all the resources that we apply to crime fighting. So from what I saw of my research, it seemed to me that what they achieved in New York told us two great things. The first was that the police had to believe that they could make a contribution to fighting crime, and that the inexorable rise of crime over the years could be halted. If you take us back to the 60s, 70s, 80s, then in fact the general accepted philosophy was that crime was going to go like this. Nobody could do anything about it, crime would always go up. Because what Bill Bratton brought into New York, together with support of Giuliani, was that in fact they said, actually, we're not going to tolerate that. We are going to try and do something about it at the very least. And you saw in this country Michael Howard make the same point. And the second thing was that then they managed police performance in a very tight way. Now, what I would never argue for is managing every dot and comma and filling in tick boxes for the sake of it. Work out what works, which is the evidence-based link, Make sure we set clear and achievable targets and then make sure it gets delivered. And it seems to me that's a vital function of management as much as it is of leadership. I just thought I'd mention a few of the tactics that I think over time I've found effective in the past, which I think for the future can stand us all in good stead. The first one is around detection. I take the point that, of course, you can't detect all crime, and the detection rates of themselves are not indicative of a good or a bad police force. But they're not a bad indicator of what I think the victim might expect of a police service. There are three broad ways in which we detect crime. Number one is we catch them doing it. Number two is forensics evidence links the criminal to the scene. Number three is someone tells us who did it. I don't think there are any other ways. Within the latter group, we have victims, we have informants, we have crime stoppers. I suppose my broad point is that if these things work, then if as managers and leaders we actually drive people to make sure that those things get done properly, regularly 80 to 90% of the time, it's amazing what comes out the other end. It's not okay to fail to find a fingerprint that's at the scene of a burglary. Having found the fingerprint, it's not okay not to identify it. And having identified the person, it's not okay to leave them at liberty for 7 weeks when they're a spree offender who just caused another 24 burglaries. Now, that's susceptible to some tight management. Seems to me that that's an evidence-based approach. Now, that quick sketch that I've just run through in terms of detections, I was talking to Larry probably 2-3 years ago now, and said that, you know, for myself, professionally, I come to this conclusion with this great shaft of light that there were these three ways of catching people committing crime. He says, yeah, somebody discovered that in 1950-odd. So, oh, that's interesting, because no one ever told me. Now, my point is not whether I'm right, nor whether this piece of research was right. I think it is. But where do we train our BCU commanders? Where do we train our SIOs? Where do we train our people in making sure that if these are the three great buckets that help to detect crime, one, it's not a bad idea to have monitoring systems to deliver it. It's not a bad idea to have technology to warn the manager that things are going skew-if, because in the cells where we believe we take fingerprints off 100% of the people who pass through our custody suites, and then we realise it's gone down to 82% because nobody checked. Because what started out as a 98-year-old shoplifter that nobody wants to take the fingerprints, it deteriorated to, well, actually, we just let them pass through. So it seems to me that rigorous application of things that work, if only we are careful enough to keep checking, is really important. One of the tactics that we had in Merseyside was called Tango. We call it, in London, we call it Cubo. This is about the taking of uninsured vehicles off the road. We take them off the road for those people who are not from this jurisdiction. If we take an uninsured and unlicensed or untaxed vehicle off the road, first of all, the person will be prosecuted. If they don't get it uninsured, taxed or tested, we'll keep it, and we can sell it, and we can keep the proceeds. This is a vital piece of work for me, for the police. First of all, because it takes uninsured vehicles off the road, which they shouldn't be on the road, it's against the law. But more importantly, 70% of the people we take vehicles off, this type of person is a criminal. We're not talking about the good guys who forget to insure their vehicles, because the good people go and get their insurance. We are talking about the vast majority of these people are criminals. What we also know is of this group is that they're 5 times more likely to have a road traffic collision, and if they have one, they're 9 times more likely to have caused injury to someone. So this is a group of people who are both criminal and dangerous. So the reason we take their vehicles is, one, because they shouldn't be doing it. Number two is because the impact we can have, if we take all those vehicles, really can have a major impact too. And the same theory underpins the criminal recovery of assets. If you accept that organised crime is based on crime for profit, which is the majority of the motive for these people involved, then why don't we follow the money? Now, of course, to some extent we do, but my argument is we have to industrialise it and make sure we take that profit out of crime at the rate at which it goes in. Another tactic we used was a round called Hawk. This was not evidence-based. This was about around a very good sergeant who became an inspector on the Wirral, who worked out that if you kept going and getting warrants for people who you had intelligence, who had drugs, and put the door in, you either found drugs or other forms of criminality. You didn't wait 6 months to to carry out a surveillance operation. You got the warrant, which was your test of ethics. Did the magistrate give you a warrant? Then you put the door in. It's amazing. You just kept them on the run. Now, of course, there were other things happening about international supply as well. But it was a tactic that if you did all across the force, all together, it's amazing what effect it could have. Antisocial behaviour, coming back to the repeat offender profile. Antisocial behaviour is one of the biggest indicators that, for me, that repeat offenders, repeat locations, repeat victims is something that actually, if we take pay attention to it, can really make a difference. We created an antisocial behaviour squad on the grounds, if not for nothing else, that for those who are in the police service or in the audience, they will know that the police are ever so good at creating squads. We do it. It works, on the whole. If they become chronic squads, it doesn't work quite as often. But, you know, you concentrate people in a team, you give them a task, and then they go and deliver it. But we've never created an antisocial behaviour squad, despite the fact that people tell us it's the biggest thing that they want us to do something about. So we did, and in Merseyside, the one that we created had two-thirds police and one-third fire service. Because the police went in and restored order, and the fire service helped end diversion afterwards. It took about a 12-week period, and we moved it around, hitting at the top 10 priorities in the force. Again, something that if we concentrate most on the repeat victims and offenders, it's amazing the impact they can have over time. And the only final thing I mentioned in terms of tactics, possibly two things. One is that one of the other things we tried, and we're trying again in London, is to concentrate on one tactic on 2 days after 28, so only about 5% of the working year, on tactics that all parts of the force did on the same day at the same time. On the grounds, if you're not careful, as what the research shows is, all you do is you squeeze a problem from one part of the force area to another, and they start to commit the crime in another part, not quite as efficiently sometimes. But if you concentrate your tactics for the whole all of the BCUs together, it's amazing what sort of effect it can have. And if nothing else, at least it shows the public that you care and you're doing something where the mass media can report, and suddenly they can realise that it can have an impact. The only final thing I was going to mention before I moved on to communication in terms of evidence-based policing is that what we know is that there are two big drivers of crime, possibly three, in this country and I suggest right around the world. Number one is alcohol, number two is drugs, and number three is around young people. Not because young people are the cause of crime, but they are disproportionately affected as victims or as suspects. So if we concentrate our efforts in those three areas, it's amazing the impact we can have. So the licensing of alcohol and its controlled supply is something that most democratic states have gone for. But I'd argue that over the last 10 to 20 years, the approach to alcohol sale is liberalised. And number two is correspondingly the police have withdrawn from an area in which we've always shown that by monitoring and rigorous policing, we can make a difference. This is not about arresting drunks in town centres on Friday and Saturday nights, although that plays part in it. It's about saying it's a privilege to have an alcohol sale licence, and by concentrating on those who don't deal with that privilege very well, you can have a massive impact. So 16-year-olds drinking in pubs and clubs, there will be problems. Sadly, it's a feature of life. It's a physiological feature. It's a factor of maturity. But if we withdraw from policing that type of thing, then it can have a massive effect. And I think the impact of drugs, which is not directly on behaviour, but it's more about the acquisitive behaviour linked to it, again, if we ignore that level of criminality, we do so at our peril. And in terms of young people, there's a great opportunity to both educate and stop them getting involved in a life of crime. The next part of what we did around total policing is that what we said was it was really important to do these things day in, day out, monotonously, regularly, but without the distraction of saying, well, we've just had another emergency, therefore we can't do it today. Even if you achieved 80% of the time, you'd achieve it far more than if we didn't have any kind of system. But we had to communicate it to the public. And that meant using local radio, mass media, with simple ideas, simply expressed. It always has come fairly natural to me on the grounds that I am not able to express very complicated things in a very complicated way. But there is a great benefit, I think, in leaders who are able to say simply what they intend and what they've delivered, and then to take it on the chin if it doesn't go well. Because I think that it isn't as though our own staff or the public cannot understand complicated ideas. But try and think about the last news broadcast you heard and tell me what was in it. because I'd argue that, in fact, we all have a short-term memory problem unless we really apply ourselves to understanding what the news and what all the communications that we receive every day is about. So I think it does deserve to be simple and therefore, I would argue, impactive. I've told you a little about, obviously, about what we achieved in Merseyside. And I've said, you know, Nick was kind enough to point out one or two things we achieved. I don't say that other people didn't achieve similar things. I don't say that there is no other way of doing it. But one of the things I was very proud of, apart from you said about the recorded crime levels, and people will know the arguments about recorded crime, but it's also true of the British Crime Survey stats show the same picture too. And I just think it really is important. But the thing that I was most proud of in all the things that we did was two other things as well, because we concentrate our efforts on getting the waste out of the back office and leading to us recruiting 9% more police officers, not because someone else gave us money, because we used our money to spend it on frontline police. And it seems to me that, you know, you can drive better performance that way. And the second thing was that we concentrate on our cultural values. It wasn't just about an unthinking, and some may regard a simplistic addressing of crime fighting. We spent 5 years working through our leaders on our values, so that within 3 years, we actually had the lowest number of complaints in the country per officer when we'd been at the bottom of the pile, and our civil litigation reduced as well. So it has to be about how you work with your people, about you impose higher standards, based, I hope, on evidence-based approach, not about saying to people, just go out and lock people up, because I think that just wouldn't work. Probably for our culture, is quite a dangerous thing too. I only wanted to say a few words as coming towards a close, which is about how we're trying to apply that to London. I've been down there now since September the 26th, so about 8 months. And in the life of an organisation, that's fairly short, and in the life of the Met, it's incredibly short, given that it's quite a big beast. We have 53,000 people, we have a budget of about £3.5 billion. We try our best to provide a service to 7.5 million, with about 2 million people who are visiting the tellers every day. So the size of the task is quite large. The first thing we've had is a change round in our team. Some of it, well, all of it really dictated by happenstance. My arrival was by happenstance, the deputy who is retired, and so you go on. But we've now got probably two-thirds of the police team has changed. We've just selected a new director of HR and resources, and for reasons that may be blindly obvious, but we've just got a new head of press that we'll be selecting over the next couple of weeks. We're hoping it's going to be a quieter period. So I suppose the first 8 months have been getting a team, a new team built, and now we've got to create a plan. The second thing during that time is that the Met has undergone another challenge, which is around a full course. The rest of the country will be electing, as Peter said, police crime commissioners in November. Well, on January 16th, the police authority in London stopped being in existence. A deputy mayor took over that responsibility. So from January 17th, we had a new person. That was a chap called Kit Malthouse, who previously had been the chair of the police authority. We then had a matter of weeks before the May London election, the local elections, selected a mayor. Now, as it happened, it was the same mayor as the previous one. Boris Johnson got in. But there was a new deputy mayor who arrived. So from May the 6th until now, just a matter of a few weeks, a new chap arrived, Stephen Greenhalgh, and we now need to get into a new form of a new dynamic together with a police crime scrutiny committee that the GLA has created, a new one in this last few weeks. So although we've started, I don't think we yet know where we'll finish. It's a new dynamic. We'll learn lessons over the next few months. But I'm just trying to sketch out that during that time, we've had an unsettled senior team following on from 18 months of being unsettled. And then number two, we've also got a new governance layer. So I think all that's meant is we haven't got great conclusions yet about our plan for the future. But what I've set is the ambition that by Christmas of this year, so about 6 months, we've got to do our thinking. I think we've got an opportunity to do that because we received £90 million that we weren't expecting, which frankly the rest of the country didn't have, to keep our police numbers high during the Olympics. Had absolutely nothing to do with the mayoral election, if you believe that. But we were great beneficiaries. We got £90 million, which has helped us keep our police officer numbers high. But whatever the motivation, we're hardly going to reject £90 million and keeping our police officer numbers at the levels they are now. But by Christmas, I think we've got to do three things. One is set out a clear vision for the next 3 to 5 years, and that's what we'll do. The second thing is, by the way, we've got to find £500 million worth of saving. When you say it quickly, sounds all right. We'll do it. But I want to do it in that order. We have to set out an ambition of what we need to be, and we need to find £500 million. Certainly not the reverse. The reverse is quite easy. You just slash 5% off your budgets month or year after year. After 4 years, you've saved 20%. It's very straightforward. You have less people. But it's a salami slice towards a vision of what might be. And I think we ought to be better than that. And I know we are better than that. To create a vision of what we are going to be, and then to make sure we deliver the savings. And the third thing is to deliver cultural change at the same time. I'm only going to close on 2 points, really, which is that I'm convinced that we do need an evidence-based approach to policing, but I would argue that either we or academia have let each other down. I think that policing is a vitally important service that we provide to this country. 60 million people deserve it, and all the people who visit us. We have about 250,000 people dedicated at least to providing a police service throughout this country, and yet there are no faculties of policing. There's lots of evidence around. I mean, we've got a great Institute of Criminology here. But that's criminology for a study around criminology, which picks and mixes from sociology, from forensic science. And I would argue that, in fact, we deserve, the people of this country deserve to have a rigorous academic process to test all the research from around the world, from this country. When we put BCU commanders in that said, actually, this is how you might lead a police organisation. It tells them a little about how they may work with partners in the community, the things that have worked in the past, the things that could work in the future, that really weaves together those things that are unique and extraordinary for policing, and not expect people to guess it, not expect people to go into law, to go into other aspects, other disciplines, and then to take from those bits that they feel might work best for the future. I know that Larry's certainly interested, as are some of the universities and the government is. But I just think that we have got a great opportunity to leave a legacy for the people who will succeed us that builds on the best of the past. It seems to me if we have that bedrock of information, that bedrock of evidence, then our leaders will be trained in it, our people will be selected through a process that involves that knowledge, and it's something we haven't had in the past. So some of the mistakes we've all made, because sadly, I don't think we've ever learnt mainly the lesson from the past. Research-based evidence is tested and then make sure that we know what we think we've discovered and test it against international dimensions as well as local ones. So for me, that's vital. And the only final thing we'll mention is that if we can manage to get to that holy grail, first of all, having an evidence base on which to build. Secondly, then using the police professional body to take that and then make it pragmatic and make it practical. We have to have technology that will help us to achieve those things too. I think we are a great people business. I doubt we will ever have far less people than we could have less people, but I doubt we'll have half of the people and still expect to achieve all the things we have to achieve. It's no good throwing a laptop at a crowd and expecting it to go away. There's something fundamental about having people in policing. There's no absolute number, I don't think, that we could worship and say it has to be that particular number. But I do think that we've not got the best out of the investment we've made in technology to make sure that the evidence base that we have has been made sure that we do policing in that way. We in the Met spend £220 million a year on IT. The country spends £1.2 billion on IT, and I'd argue it's very poor. It's produced a huge number of lists. I can tell you how many burglaries there were yesterday, how many items of antisocial behaviour. What about a piece of kit that stops it? What about a piece of kit that helps the victim? And that exists. If you looked at technology like ANPR, automatic number plate recognition, it catches burglars. As we perhaps saw in South Yorkshire just a few days ago, really significant arrest in terms of terrorism. Started from automatic number plate recognition. It's not the only technology that's out there. And not only in catching criminals, but also in supporting victims. We aren't getting the bangs for the bucks in terms of that £1.2 billion. And most of our reinvestments in technology are around legacy. What did we have before? And when the license runs out, are we going to replace it? And I'd include in that a huge piece of IT that we use time and time again. We keep replacing. Command and control, tens of millions of pounds being spent on it. Doesn't help you to get into any scene of crime any quicker. So some nice amp management information. They don't get you there any quicker, and yet the whole reason it's supposed to be there is to help you to get and respond to the victim's needs and attend the scene. But we're being ripped off in large numbers, and it may well be that the people in the audience who are from IT firms will stand the ground in terms of, one, whether or not we've articulated what we want, and number two, whether they've delivered what they should have. But the collective result is not profound. So for me, if we are going to have an evidence base, we need to have it as an academically rigorous process, and I think the universities ought to have faculties of policing. Secondly, I think the police professional body is a way of actually making that pragmatic and implemented. And finally, I think technology can make sure it's routine in the things that we do without having to have great bureaucracies just to constantly monitor what we do time after time. But we'll return in my final words to what I believe the police are for, which is, I think we are here to fight crime. We're the ones with great privilege, great duty, and a lot of people, other people would like to do it. We have many other things to do too, but the singular mission of the police that no one else has the privilege to do is to go look at burglars and rapists. And I think if we keep our eye on that mission, then some of the other things can fall into place. And if we rely on the things that we know work best, then we'll be the more effective and efficient that possibly we can. But thanks for taking the time to listen, and I hope if there are any questions, quite happy to take them. Thank you.